What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, "Doctor, doctor, give me the news." I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and this is going to be part two of our two-part series on vaccines. And last time we talked about the history of vaccines and how they work, and this time we're going to do what we do on the show and look at the future.
Yeah.
The future of vaccines, where we can go with this technology. But if you haven't listened to that original episode, the one we did last time, you should probably go back, listen to that one first to get the foundation.
The science basis.
Yeah, yeah, the foundation for the discussion we're about to have. And then come back and rejoin us here for a journey into the great unknown.
Yeah, in fact, we're going to start with some FUD. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
It's true. We mentioned right back at the beginning of the last episode that I have a theory that news about developments in vaccine technology kind of gets undersold in the media a little bit because the media space for vaccine-related stories is mostly taken up by anti-vaccine activism controversy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you were to do internet searches on things about vaccines and, just – you're using good search techniques, a lot of your results are going to come up with some very non-scientifically minded material that has no real relationship to any proven foundation.
Yeah. If I could be straight with all of you guys out there in podcast world, I suggested this topic specifically because over on a show called What the Stuff, which is a video show that we run through How Stuff Works, we published a video about misconceptions about the flu. Caroline Irvin hosted it. Mm-hmm. I wrote the script. It was a really terrific episode. And the comment thread on YouTube is interesting.
I gotta ask, was there a sizable anti-vax
incredibly sizable.
Interesting.
And actually,
and
even
upsetting.
Even the pro-vaccination faction was being really quite impolite.
Yeah.
Which I don't think was helping the matter.
Well, and this is
and
one of those,
part of why the debate gets so hot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This was, well, for one, we're literally talking about life and death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is not some minor issue. This is something that, you know, as we mentioned in part one, vaccines have saved countless lives. Not just the people they directly saved, but their descendants, right?
And also herd immunity. And we'll get into this a little bit later on, but protecting other people who can't catch a disease from you if you don't have that disease,
yes,
is a really huge part of why vaccination is rad.
Well, we should address this topic, I think, by starting with the sort of historical facts about where the current strain of this controversy came from. Now, one of the things I think we should say at the outset is that vaccines are medications, and pretty much every medication that exists can, in some number, some subset of cases, have side effects.
Sure.
And this is
absolutely
true. This is true of vaccines as well. But the problem is the side effects that have been claimed most of the time by the anti-vaccination movement are not the real side effects, or they've been claimed to happen at a much higher frequency than is actually observed in the medical literature. And I think the most commonly cited side effect has been this perceived association between vaccines and autism.
Yeah, that's the
big one.
Easily the most covered of all of the controversies, right?
The big tuna in the basket, we might
say.
Yeah.
So, as we often do on Forward Thinking, the vaccine autism connection, or lack thereof, as I wrote in our notes. The general thought was that. Because of the publication of a particular paper, and I'll get to that in a second, that childhood vaccination schedules were somehow not just correlated, but had a cause-effect relationship with the rise in the diagnosis of autism in children.
Mm-hmm.
This all really got started back in 1997 when Andrew Wakefield, who was a British surgeon, published a paper in The Lancet allegedly establishing this link between MMR vaccine, mumps, measles, and rubella, I believe, and a rise in the number of children being diagnosed with autism. Now, The Lancet is a highly respected journal.
Mm-hmm.
Like it.
Oh,
this,
yeah.
This isn't a blog that someone has put up and given a vaguely scientific or medical sounding name and then treats it as if it were a peer-reviewed journal. This is top-notch stuff in the field of medicine.
Yes, but even a respected journal can make mistakes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And in this case, since the publication of this article, the research has been really gone over and through, and it
doesn't hold up.
It does not hold up.
No.
The scientific method was not being used properly here.
Some people have gone so far as to accuse Wakefield of knowingly misrepresenting data, not just cherry picking, but mm-hmm. misrepresenting.
There were procedural errors. There were undisclosed financial conflicts of interest.
Yeah, essentially Wakefield was getting money from parties that had a vested interest in alternatives to vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a big deal, and eventually took longer than many of us would have liked. The scandal cost Wakefield his medical license in the UK, and The Lancet retracted the paper and said, it was a mistake to ever publish it in the first place.
We don't stand by the results anymore, and they don't seem to be true.
However, when a cat is let out of a bag, the bag is no longer filled with cat.
Especially,
and so it was with this.
And it's even worse if that cat goes on to have many, many litters of kittens.
Yes, including people who have a visible place in the public consciousness, like people who have a platform upon which to continuously promote this idea of a connection between vaccines and autism.
Yeah, this has been a factor in the history of this debate, because even though the medical establishment considers this link between vaccines and autism completely debunked,
mm-hmm.
It has had some very popular celebrity endorsements.
Yeah.
And you guys know him. You've heard him.
Yeah.
I mean,
we're not gonna
name names.
Yeah. Mostly because I won't be able to complete the rest of this podcast. I will just be drooling and foaming and yelling.
Yeah, absolute fact of the matter is, and I'm sure you've heard it before, but hear it again from us, There have been studies, peer-reviewed, well-researched, like good science studies that have shown that there is no link between vaccines and autism.
Exactly.
It just does not exist as far as a scientific method can tell.
Right. Like, as certain as we can be about anything, at this point we can be certain that vaccines do not lead to autism. There are other theories about why the diagnosis for autism has been on the rise, largely due to things like redefining what the autism spectrum is.
Absolutely.
The autistic spectrum, I should say.
Yeah.
And by redefining it, suddenly if you have a wider net, what do you know? More people fall into that definition.
Yeah. If you're paying attention to these poor people who otherwise would have slipped through the cracks, then of course you're going to find more of them.
Right. So,
and furthermore, okay, adding to this problem of celebrities, misinforming the public about this issue, you have a few misguided people in the government who have accused the CDC of destroying or covering up evidence that vaccines cause autism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've heard about that, these accusations have been proven to be completely unfounded. Data from the studies that these governmental people were talking about was neither destroyed nor covered up. It's there. You could go look at it for yourself. And furthermore, every study that has been conducted that potentially indicated a link between vaccines and autism has been shown to have used really shoddy statistics to bend the data to their wishes.
Yeah. Again, largely cherry picking information, ignoring anything that does not back up your claim,
mm-hmm.
and only picking the stuff that does seem to back up your claim. That's bad science. For anything, right? Not just with vaccines, but any kind of science where you feel motivated to only present the information that supports your hypothesis, that's bad science. It's not the way science is supposed to work. And that's why we have the peer review process,
mm-hmm.
so that others can come in and really scrutinize the work that you've done to make sure that that hasn't happened. Sometimes it even happens unconsciously. I'm not necessarily saying that people do it on purpose all the time.
Well, and sometimes you can look at numbers and think that they're leading in one way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if perhaps your sample size is too small, or you've assumed a variable is in play that is not.
Or there are variables that you did not take into account.
Sure. Absolutely. Like lots of completely honest mistakes can happen in this kind of situation.
Now, at the end of the day, not vaccinating people leads to disease outbreaks and potentially to fatalities. As an example, in California, back in 2010, there was an outbreak of pertussis, also known as whooping cough. Whooping cough had not been seen in any large numbers for 60 years in California. And then in 2010, there's an outbreak of more than 9,000 cases. So that also included 10 infant deaths, right? And when we talk about herd immunity, part of that is our responsibility to be vaccinated against diseases so we don't pass them on to people who are too young to have been vaccinated already.
Yeah, or who have compromised immune systems
exactly.
and can receive those vaccines.
Yeah, so I'm getting a little head up about this. I apologize for that. But this is one of those topics that I really get very passionate about. So at any rate, vaccines and autism, there is no credible scientific link between the two. This is not the only thing that vaccines have been allegedly connected to. The another one is type 1 diabetes. This was popularized by Dr. J. Bartholo Klassen, who had claimed that the rise in diabetes diagnoses in the U.S. were tied to childhood vaccination schedules. So very similar to the autism story, and also very similar to the autism story, other scientific studies do not seem to bear this out at all. One of the ones I looked at was a study that followed 21,421 children over the course of 10 years after they had received the HIB conjugate vaccine, the HIB conjugate vaccine, and found that there was no greater incidence in diabetes than a control group of 22,557 children who did not receive the vaccination. In other words, there was no rise in diabetes in the test group compared to the control group. That's a pretty decent sample size.
I was about to say, yeah, that's what you like to call a good sample size.
Yeah. And of course, that's not the only study that has been conducted in terms of vaccines and diabetes. That was just the one that I had looked at to choose as an example. But again, there does not seem to be any credible scientific link between the two. There's also the fear about vaccines containing toxins.
Heavy metals, for example, or formaldehyde.
Yep. Yeah, because there are now some vaccines, like we've outlawed some of these chemicals to be used in vaccines, even though at the levels that they were in vaccines, they were well below toxic levels.
Right, right.
Right? Because there's certain chemicals that you can come into contact with and not have any toxicity. There's no toxicity involved. You have to have more than that.
Yeah. If you eat enough nutmeg, it can kill you, guys. Don't eat too much nutmeg.
Yeah.
Don't just chew on nutmeg all day.
Right.
It's bad for you.
Or like if you ate 5 pounds of apple seeds, then you might have enough cyanide to actually do some damage to you.
Sure.
But otherwise, the levels are so low that they aren't toxic. That was the very case of the materials that are in vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a misunderstanding of what toxic means.
Yeah.
Because,
of course, formaldehyde is toxic. Of course, mercury is a bad thing to drink.
Right. But there are certain levels that you can encounter that aren't going to harm you. In fact, when it comes to things like formaldehyde, our own metabolic processes create formaldehyde.
Right in your body.
Yeah.
All the time.
And more so than you would find in any vaccine. So the thing that drives me nuts in this is when people are will say, like, oh, the same chemicals that are in formaldehyde are in this this material that's inside a vaccine. I said, have you looked to see what other stuff these chemicals are in? I mean, they're in, like, lots of things. You don't understand chemistry is what this is telling me.
Yeah, yeah.
But at any rate, that's another fear that is largely unfounded. Clearly, any substance that we're introducing to our body, there needs to be a great deal of testing to make certain that it's not toxic. But these are materials that at these levels we know aren't toxic. Another fear: that vaccines cause the very disease they're meant to prevent. In other words, you go in, you get a vaccination, and then 2 days later, you've come down with whatever it is you got vaccinated against. Clearly, the vaccine did it, right?
If you don't know what you're talking about, this makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, we talked a little bit about this one in the previous episode.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's the way that vaccines work is that it takes a while for your body to take the information in the vaccine and to extrapolate it out and build up a resistance to that disease.
Right. And in that time between when it gets the information and when it's ready, you could still catch that disease.
Mm-hmm.
You could still encounter it and end up becoming sick because your body isn't in the ready state yet.
Right, right. And we should say that it's not that this has never in the history of vaccines happened.
No, it did happen once. It happened one time.
Literally one time?
Yeah.
Literally one patient?
The oral polio vaccine, which is no longer used in the United States. But yeah, that's the one time there was a recorded case where this actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
In all the other cases, the reactions that a person had to vaccines, they were something else. It wasn't that they caught the disease they got vaccinated
from the vaccine.
Against. Sometimes there's a complication because the immune system reacts in a way that is far too strong, and as a result, someone can suffer something like seizures or brain damage, even in some cases, but it's super rare for that to happen. But it's not the disease that did it. It's the body's own immune system that went haywire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the case of the flu, we should say there's a lot of different strains of the flu going around at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you catch the flu after you've received a vaccine, it could just be a different strain, because the vaccine for the flu that's sent out every year is made to target 2 to 4 strains that global researchers have guessed are going to be the most active in the coming year.
Oh, right.
And they're making real educated guesses, you guys.
Yeah. So it's like they're looking
it's
at
not
a pie.
Just a guess.
Yeah.
Not
like a dice roll, but
They might be looking at a big pie chart, right? And saying, like, this particular strain of the virus has this percentage chance of being one of the really prevalent ones this year.
Yeah.
So
they're looking
at the whipped cream.
Yeah. They're looking
not
at
kind of pie chart, but yeah,
they're looking at patient data from people around the world.
Yeah,
and but you know, it's completely possible to catch a different strain than what was in the vaccine that you
We've
received.
Seen outbreaks of flu where it would end up being a strain of flu that everyone was fairly certain was going to be more or less inert.
Yeah,
and turn out that they were wrong. It does happen. So anyway, that's a list of things that people often fear are bad or can go wrong with vaccines. Now, there are some things that can go wrong, and we want to address them.
Sure, we've mentioned a couple times already that, like all medications, vaccines can have side effects. They typically, the approved vaccines that are given out are going to have an extremely low incidence of catastrophic side effects. Though maybe, you know, one in a million type things can go very wrong. The standard side effects you might get are like soreness at the injection site or something
maybe
like that.
Maybe a low-grade fever depending upon the vaccination that you received. And that's your body's immune system kicking
in
gear.
And
obviously if you are someone who has a compromised immune system, it could be much more serious than that, which is why you know, most vaccines you would never administer to someone who has that kind of condition.
You can have allergies to certain ingredients in vaccines.
That can be pretty scary. I mean, as someone who has, I have a couple of pretty severe allergies, not to anything that's in vaccines, as far as I know, anyway. But, you know, that's one of those things where the reaction is pretty quick after you're introduced to the thing, and it can be pretty terrifying. But again, that's your body misidentifying something as being super duper dangerous, so it goes into hyper attack mode.
You gotta stay away from the shellfish vaccine.
For me it's lobster and alcohol. Those are the two things I can't have because I will go into anaphylactic shock. It's exciting, it's a fun trick to do at parties, but I can only do it once. One other problem that we sometimes encounter with vaccines is access, right?
And then absolutely,
you know, this is sometimes in the case of shortages where we literally do not have enough vaccines for the populations that are most in need of them. Sometimes it has to do with the vaccines are not in the part of the world where we need them to be, right? Like the outbreak may be in one part of the world and all the vaccine production centers could be in a different part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that issue is that it's difficult to ship vaccines. A lot of vaccines have to be kept at a very low temperature in order for them to remain viable. And we'll talk about this a little bit later when we're talking about the future of vaccines. Not all places in the world have temperature-controlled storage. So while you could argue, hey, why is this even an issue? We have vaccines for that disease. Well, if we can't get the vaccine to the people who need it, then there's still very much a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, the problem isn't so much with the vaccine itself and what it is, but rather how much of it do we have and do we have it in the right place at the right time? But that is a serious issue with vaccines. It has nothing to do with, you know, autism or diabetes or anything along those lines. Now, let's go on and talk about some of the future vaccines, because there's some really exciting stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And to start us out, I just wanted to give a shout out to genome sequencing, because being able to take a look at the entire genetic code of a bacterium or virus has let researchers start to make, again, those very educated guesses about sequences of code that could work as antigens in the future. It's sometimes called reverse vaccinology, like trying to create a vaccine out of something that you're not sure will work, but this might be the right puzzle piece to plug in there. There's also been study into the genes that turn on in microbes when those microbes switch from being passive to being active, when they become virulent, that is. And we talked a little bit about that one in our episode about antibiotics and bacterial communication. That one was called "Forget Going Viral, Bacterial Communication is Awesome."
Who came up with that title?
That's Jonathan.
Was it me?
I can only assume that
probably was me.
It wasn't me.
I was
the
one who called Operation Plowshare. That's the bomb.
Oh my goodness gracious!
I'm not proud of that, but I did it.
That episode about bacterial communication came out in September of 2015. If you would like to go check that one out. Genome sequencing, good technology. It's not like a new technique the way that a lot of these others are going to be. But I just wanted to say, hey, thanks, genes.
Yeah.
Good job.
So some other stuff that's under research and development right now in various companies around the world. I mean, vaccines are big business, right? We're talking, that's part of the pharmaceutical business. It is.
I did want to say that, like, that's part of the reason that some people distrust vaccines because of big pharma. And, you know, and I get it. I get that it's a scary industry.
Right. And there are some downsides too, right? Like there's some diseases that big pharma might not be that motivated to go out and develop vaccines for because there's not a lot of money back there. If you're talking about diseases that largely affect the developing world versus the developed world, mm-hmm. there might be this, it's pretty grim to talk about this, but there might be this, you know, investment versus reward discussion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and actually that was a issue with Big Pharma and the flu vaccine for a number of years. It was definitely like a loss item mm-hmm. for them, for most companies for a very long time. There's a couple newer vaccines that they're able to incorporate more strains of the flu. Mm-hmm. In a single vaccine, and so those are actually like capable of making money because you can sell them to richer populations as like an upgrade mm-hmm. sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, certainly the flu vaccine and some other vaccines as well are not big money makers.
Right.
These are not the things that Big Pharma is going out and looking at to make all of their boku bucks.
Fortunately, there's still quite a few labs out there that are actively looking into improving our processes mm-hmm. with vaccines.
Yeah, yeah. It is right. It's a complicated price issue is basically what I wanted to say.
That's a good point. It's yeah. an excellent point. One of those technologies we're talking about is live recombinant vaccines. This is the practice of using a vaccine of one attenuated virus or bacterial strain to prompt an immune response to a different illness.
Well, wait a minute. Isn't this kind of what happened when Edward Jenner cowpox into one person to protect him from smallpox?
Very much so. Yeah, that's a great example of an early use of this. So really, it's an idea that's been around since we had the word vaccination.
Well, this is a little bit more of a direct application, though, because mm-hmm. in that case, he was using one disease to prevent another. And in this one, you're directly putting some of the dangerous disease into a less dangerous disease.
Yeah. 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 It gets a little, yeah, exactly. It does get a little more complicated.
It's more like a turducken.
Right. Right. So.
Of infection.
Let's see if my example that I wrote when I was getting into nap mode makes sense. Here's how I wrote it out. I said, so you want to vaccinate somebody for disease A. All right. So you take a vaccine that's meant for disease B, totally different disease. But you incorporate some of the protein from disease A into the vaccine for disease B. So now the disease B contains a little bit of protein from disease A, and you administer that to an uninfected person. Their immune system kicks into gear. Their immune system recognizes the protein that belongs to disease A, even though disease A is not really represented otherwise in this vaccine. And as a result, you develop a resistance or immunity to disease A. This is a great way of using a method to protect someone from a disease that otherwise would be far too dangerous to introduce even in a vaccine form.
Now, what would make a disease too dangerous to introduce? Would it be if you can't make it safe enough? Like you can't knock it out the way you would these others?
Mm-hmm. HIV is a great example of this, right?
Yeah.
So HIV is so potentially dangerous that you cannot attenuate it enough for it to fall below the threshold of danger.
Yeah.
You would constantly be endangering any uninfected person with...
It's just so virulent. Yeah.
You could contract HIV and then that could develop into AIDS. So this is an example of a way to get around that where you incorporate some of that protein. So it's not the actual HIV virus. It's just some of the protein that marks it as such. And help your immune system defend against it. Now, HIV in particular, there might be a totally different vector that we discover to vaccinate against that. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that a little bit later.
But this one holds a lot of promise. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Another one that I think is really neat is the DNA vaccine approach. So these vaccines consist of DNA coding for a specific antigen. You take that DNA coding and you inject the vaccine directly into muscle tissue, which sounds so comfortable.
Well, that's what you do with most vaccines.
Yeah. Whenever it's worded that way, I can't help but feel that tetanus shot, right? Like
yeah.
That's the one that I always
Jonathan,
associate.
He prefers them injected into his eyeballs.
Ooh.
I have had things.
Why would you even say that, Joe?
I've had my eyes messed with before.
Very
thank
upsetting.
You. We haven't done an episode about LASIK.
Ooh.
I can talk about it. Strangely enough, it doesn't bother me at this point. But so the DNA from the antigen integrates itself into the patient's cells, which begin to produce the antigen. And because the antigen is a molecular marker that indicates a foreign microbe, you can go back and listen to our first episode if you don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. This triggers the body's immune response. Now, one big advantage to
Hold on. So you are essentially programming cells within your body to make the antigens that you would need to recognize for the vaccine.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So they don't have to pick it up from any microbes.
Right. So these antigens, remember, are just molecular markers. They're not they're not the actual disease carrying microbe, but rather kind of like their name badge. Yeah. So your cells are printing out these name badges. Your immune system recognizes that and then can build that into its antibody response.
Mm-hmm. It can take those antigens and build it into its DNA code so that's a name badge that it knows to look for and kick right out of its bar.
Right. So even though it's never encountered that particular disease, if you ever encountered it in the future, at least in theory, you would be able to produce the correct antibodies to fight it off.
So why would this be better than a regular vaccine?
Well, DNA is relatively easy to manufacture, so it could be very efficient. It could be very relatively inexpensive compared to other methods of producing vaccines. But there are some drawbacks as well, because you'd say, well, if it's easy to do, then why isn't that the standard? The big reason is that they've yet to be proven to induce an immune response strong enough to create immunity to prevent future infection of diseases. So in other words, they can be used to help create antibodies for a particular disease, but so far we have not demonstrated this approach as being effective enough to truly create immunity.
Mm-hmm.
So you could still be vulnerable to some of these diseases. Your body would be fighting it off, but it might not win. So that's a big reason why DNA vaccines haven't been completely adopted as the new approach. But there's a lot of work going into improving it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible that this will be useful in creating vaccines for diseases against which we have no current preventative measure. But we've got some other stuff we can talk about. There's the use of adjuvants. Have you heard about these?
I read something about them. Yeah.
This is like special sauce that you put in with your vaccine to make it give it a little more oomph.
Okay.
Essentially, these are additives that stimulate the immune system in one way or another.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's not directly related to the disease necessarily, but it's meant to ramp up your immune system's response to make it more effective.
Okay, right. Because as we were discussing in the first episode, there's a few different signals that go on among the cells in your immune system that get everyone rearing to go.
Yeah, it's the big coach speech before halftime is over.
Yeah.
Come on, guys. We know what we're up against now.
Right.
Let's not give up another yard. So that's literally everything I know about football. I just exhausted it in that one analogy. That's exactly right. Like these are additives that are meant to boost that ability for your immune system to respond very quickly and build up those antibodies. There are a lot that are under various clinical trials right now that could end up increasing the efficacy of a lot of promising vaccines, as well as just increasing the efficacy of existing vaccines.
So one frontier in vaccines that has seemed like an interesting possibility to me is the delivery mechanism itself, because I know it sounds kind of sad to say this, but I do think a fairly serious obstacle to everybody getting their flu shot and stuff like that.
Is the whole shot part?
Is the needle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people don't like getting shots. In fact, I've even wondered sometimes if this contributes to parental fears about vaccines for their infants, because you don't want to see your baby stabbed with a needle.
Oh, absolutely not. And I accompanied one of my friends when her one-year-old boy was getting one of his rounds of vaccines, and the baby was fine. Literally the moment that the immediate pain of the actual prick was over, the baby was fine.
Mm-hmm.
The mother and I were traumatized because the baby was so upset for that one moment that it was,
I have an anecdote I can share,
I'm tensing up just
too.
Thinking about it.
So when I was a kid.
I get it, man.
When I was a kid and me and my sister went in to get our jabs, as the Brits call them. This was before we actually got the shots. They needed to take a quick blood sample.
Mm-hmm.
And why, when I was a kid, why was the place of choice to remove blood the tip of a finger where most of your nerve endings are? right? But they would you know, prick the tip of your finger and put a little tube down so that blood would go up the tube and all that. You all know how it works.
Yeah.
I'm still think it's ridiculous that out of all the places to take blood.
Yeah, blood comes out of everywhere, guys.
Now, let's not aim at the place where every nerve ending ever is. But at any rate, so my sister...
They should take it from right inside your nose or your nipple.
Okay. Just pass that along to Joe's doctors.
Maybe your lip or your eyeball.
You're just getting the fluid out of an eyeball. You know? Despite the fact that you...
At the back of your knee, maybe?
Yeah. let's think of all the different places you could take blood
from.
Okay, how about the lobe of an ear? At any rate,
That wouldn't hurt. That would be fine. Go ahead.
Did this to... Exactly. So they did this to my sister. So it's not directly a shot, but it shows the whole traumatizing effects of the needle. So my sister, the stoic young lady she was just old enough to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And... she stared at the nurse, one solitary tear running down her face, and she said, "Thank you." And the nurse burst into sobbing, a sobbing wreck. And I'm thinking, here's a practitioner she's working in a pediatrician's office.
She does this every day, probably.
Hundreds of kids.
She should be so desensitized to the pain of children.
Yeah. And yet my sister broke her. Good on you, sis. At any rate, yes, that was a long way of getting tangentially around the
problem. People don't like needles.
People don't like needles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My wife is one of those people. See, mm-hmm. I've gotten to a point where it doesn't faze me anymore. But for my wife, it's a big deal. It takes, you know, a lot to work herself up to going to get a shot. So one of the things that people have been looking into are alternatives to that. And we've seen some of that already, right? Like there are some vaccines that are orally administered. There's some, like the influenza virus. Mm-hmm. There's the nasal spray that's a vaccine for some strains of influenza year over year.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also some developments going on into creating patches that would administer a vaccine. The patches actually have little needles in them, but they're very, very, very tiny. So you don't really feel it. And the medication releases over time. It goes through the needles into your bloodstream, and then you end up producing the antibodies that way.
Yeah.
So
there you go. That must be the microneedle thing that I read about and didn't have time to follow up on. Microneedles.
Oh, no. Yeah, microneedles. That's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you guys have seen the Star Treks, right?
The
Star Treks.
The collective Star Treks.
I've seen
some treks around stars, yes.
So you know
is that the one with the lightsabers?
No, that would be the wars in the stars.
Okay.
No, the Star Treks. So, you know, Bones has this thing that he would always put up against someone's neck and you would hear a psh mm-hmm. sound and then they'd be magically okay. You know, they actually developed one of those once upon a time.
Yeah.
It was a device that was meant to administer shots in this kind of way. My dad actually had it done when he was younger, and he reports that it hurts like all Hades.
Hmm.
Yeah, so not an advantage to getting the old needle.
Well, keep working on that one, Bones.
It might be for people who maybe like me are bothered not so much by the pain of the injection, but the creepiness of the needle and its thinness. And sometimes I feel like I'd almost rather just get stabbed with a knife than a tiny little needle.
Like a knife is honest.
Have you been stabbed with a knife, Joe?
Yeah, I know all about it.
Okay. I was just about to say, like, I've never been stabbed with a knife, but I've been cut by a knife before.
I've stabbed myself with a knife.
Okay. It's a little different when you're doing it yourself, too.
No, you're right. I'm much less creeped out by like knives and like paper. Like I slice myself open with paper all the time.
I think I've just had enough really close calls with severe allergic reactions to just not even register the needle thing anymore.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
You're a weary desert warrior.
Yeah, I'm just
the needle landscape.
Okay,
hit me.
All right, but bringing it back. Bringing it back.
Yes.
Researchers are also working on other ways to get more vaccines, like orally, nasally, or through other mucous membranes, Yep, in your butt or vagina. That is what's going on. So, oh man, I just said butt on a science podcast, you guys. I feel real scientific.
Yeah, it's right up there with rad.
Hey. These are all very scientific words.
That's fair.
According to the Ninja Turtles. All right. So why would we want to use mucous membranes? Because lots of infections start at the mucous membranes. Lots of stuff gets into us via our mucous membranes. Mm-hmm. It's basically the primary way that stuff gets into us, unless you happen to have an open wound. Because your skin, you guys, is so good at preventing microbes from getting into you.
Yeah, it's essentially your force field.
It's one job.
Yeah.
And it does it so good. And I keep saying weird stuff on purpose. I want you guys to know that I'm very articulate.
She knows the difference between good and well, in other words.
I do. Okay. So if you put vaccines into the places where infections start, giving those cells in that area direct access to that vaccine can actually help. Mm-hmm. Nasal flu vaccines, for example, create not only the systemic response throughout your immune system, but also a local response to the flu.
Straight up your nose.
Yeah. So your body will be better prepared to fight other strains of the flu in the future, only the ones that it's receiving the vaccine for.
It's like the army itself knows what to look for, but the special forces that are in the hottest point of contention are really ready.
Yeah, totally. And so some people some researchers are working on some plant-based delivery materials, some like transgenic plant cells that could carry these antigens into your mucous membranes really effectively.
Interesting. Wow. All right. Well, anything else about interesting ways of delivering before we move on to...
Oh, yeah. Also falling vaguely into this category are practices being studied in which vaccines can be given to pregnant women so that their babies can receive those antigens while they're developing and while they have the mother's immune system to bolster its own.
That's awesome.
Because part of the spread out nature of child immunization schedules is that their immune systems are so itty bitty and so working up to bigger and better things that You've got to give it some time to adjust. But if we could give that to the mother while the baby's in the womb, then that could speed the whole process up a great deal.
And also help in those instances that I mentioned before with herd immunity, where you're worried about passing on an illness to a child who's not yet old enough to have received their scheduled immunization from a particular disease.
Right.
We also are looking at new ways to keep vaccines viable in a wider spectrum of conditions. Earlier I mentioned how in the shortages section, we were talking about that problem, about the idea of cold storage and not everywhere in the world has access to good, reliable cold storage. One of the ways we're trying to address that, obviously one way would be to make sure that cold storage was something that was easily attainable in more parts of the world, but that's a long-term...
That's a big energy resource.
Yeah, there's a whole infrastructure that has to exist for that to work, right? So another approach is, well, what if we design vaccines that are more hardy and can remain viable in a greater list of... or a greater range of temperatures, for example? And that's a big one, like trying to find ways of creating a vaccine that is able to survive at higher temperatures. The smallpox vaccine, the reason why it was so effective, or one of the reasons it was so effective, is that relatively it could remain viable at a greater range of temperatures than a lot of other vaccines can. So we could get that to different parts of the world and treat people.
But
there's a lot of work going into finding new ways of designing vaccines so that they stay viable. And one of them I thought was really interesting. It involves suspending viral particles in a layer of sugar glass that's applied to a very thin membrane. So it's a solid storage mechanism for vaccine material.
Okay.
They found that if they used this particular approach and they stored the vaccines in a relatively high temperature environment, we're talking 113 degrees Fahrenheit, or I'm assuming, Lauren, that you jumped in and helped me out with this, 45 degrees Celsius.
Yep.
Lauren's always looking out for you guys. Me, I'm like, 113 Fahrenheit, let them figure it out. But anyway, they stored it in a 113 degree Fahrenheit, 45 degrees Celsius container for 6 months, and it remained viable in all that time. They actually did this to two different viruses. They did a different group where they stored it in liquid format, and in one of those two viruses, after just a couple of weeks in the 113 degree Fahrenheit storage unit, it was completely destroyed. Like, there was no real useful material left in that sample. So this is a possible solution, at least to some types of vaccines.
Yeah.
that could mean that you could get this material to the right destination. Of course, then you have the trick of how do you turn this solid stuff back into a usable vaccine?
Right.
And there's a lot of development on that front as well. But very interesting work.
Cool.
And then we have something that doesn't really fit into those categories, but Joe, you wanted to talk about it, and it sounded really fascinating.
Yeah, I wanted to take a look at a different way of thinking about vaccination. This is a little bit more metaphorical, but it follows the same kind of idea of establishing immunity to a disease or debilitating condition. Mm-hmm. Though in this case, it would be a cognitive vaccine. And this is related to something that I talked about on an episode of the other podcast I'm on, Stuff to Blow Your Mind, where we did a couple of episodes about the science behind Tetris, the video game Tetris. And one of the things that's interesting about Tetris is it has been used in all kinds of laboratory research with people studying what Tetris does to the brains of people who play it, especially playing it under certain conditions and in conjunction with certain tasks.
Okay.
And one of the most interesting things that has been found is the work of a scientist, Emily A. Holmes out of Oxford, and her team on using Tetris as a cognitive vaccine to prevent the consolidation of traumatic memories. So y'all are familiar with PTSD.
Sure.
Sure.
You know, sometimes somebody has a traumatic experience. It might be a battlefield experience, or they're the victim of a crime, something violent happens to them, whatever. It's some kind of traumatic experience that's very unpleasant and very difficult to get past, and it can cause recurrent flashbacks. So you can be doing other stuff in your life, and suddenly you're presented with these cascading unpleasant memories that can really mess up your life.
Mm-hmm.
And traditional and current treatments to it are things like cognitive therapy, exposure therapy, certain different drugs, EMDR, which is an interesting thing I talked about on that podcast, and we got a bunch of interesting listener mail about. But anyway, what if there was a way to, instead of treating PTSD after you got it, to inoculate yourself before the symptoms set in? And so there have been a few studies on this. One was in January of 2009, and it was the study was titled, "Can Playing the Computer Game Tetris Reduce the Buildup of Flashbacks for Trauma? A Proposal from Cognitive Science." And they were working with a couple of assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that cognitive science suggests that the brain has selective resources with limited capacity. And the other one was that the neurobiology of memory suggests a six-hour window to disrupt memory consolidation. And they came up with an interesting hypothesis based on these two facts that we know from neuroscience. If you make the brain do a visuospatial task during the period of memory consolidation, you basically deny the brain the resources it needs to consolidate a memory of a physical, visual series of events, you can stop bad memories from consolidating with this great emphasis in your brain. So they had this – essentially the way their research went was they showed a bunch of people traumatic videos. Yeah, a lot of fun, huh?
I'm already glad I was not part of this experiment.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they sat people down and they made them watch these film clips that were real scenes of human surgery, fatal road traffic accidents, and drowning.
Welcome to our snuff film experiment.
Yeah, a lot of fun. I joked in the other podcast that they made them watch Faces of Death, but that doesn't it seems like something along those lines.
Yeah.
But so anyway, they'd have them do this, and then they split the participants into different groups. They had a control group who just watched the horrible movie.
And then they no help.
Yeah, and then they
just had to
suffer took a break and sat in silence.
Oh.
Then they had the other group play Tetris for 10 minutes. And the researchers, they sent the volunteers away with instructions to keep a diary on how many times they experienced flashbacks over the next week. And they checked back to see how many flashbacks the different groups had had, and they found that the ones who played Tetris had fewer flashbacks than the control group who didn't.
Wow.
And so, interestingly, they found that both groups had the same level of voluntary recall of the film. So they could both remember just as well what had happened in the
right.
movie they watched.
It's not like it blocked the actual formation of memory.
Yeah,
right.
But only the group with that did not play Tetris experienced the significant number of unintentional flashbacks to this nasty thing they saw. And so that's a really interesting effect. Why did that work? And so there are a couple things to note. Number one is that there are limitations to the study that
sure.
the researchers themselves acknowledge. Like, you know, showing somebody a movie is not the same as having a real traumatic experience in their mm-hmm. life, but it's the best you could approximate in the lab ethically.
Right.
Sure.
You could not actually create a true traumatic experience for someone.
Right.
No. It would just be wrong.
But these findings were replicated and expanded on in subsequent studies. So they did another study where they found the same thing, and then they tested different kinds of games. They said, mm-hmm. okay, well, let's take Tetris and then also like a trivia quiz game.
Mm-hmm.
And it found that Tetris worked, but the trivia quiz game didn't.
Hmm.
So it's something specifically about Tetris, and probably not just Tetris, but
like
games like it, some kind of visual, spatial.
Bejeweled, Candy Crush.
Yeah, orientation task.
I was thinking it was just the soundtrack, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Man, I love that soundtrack.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, it's obviously it's a little different from the other concepts of vaccination because you already have to be exposed to the event that would have created the mm-hmm. post-traumatic kind of a response.
It uh-huh. is. It's kind of like how, you know, you get bitten by a dog and they take you to the hospital and you get a rabies vaccine
yeah.
Immediately administered. And if you follow the course of the vaccine, I think they have to give you multiple ones. But
it's a little different now than it used to be. It used to be that it was multiple shots and they were all delivered to the abdomen.
Ugh.
It's changed since I was a kid.
Well, in both cases, you're talking about exposure.
Yeah.
You're potentially exposed to the flu, to measles, to whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And what the vaccine is doing is preventing you from getting sick from it.
Right. Yeah. So it's not a therapy. It's a preventative measure.
Right,
that's why
right.
they call it a cognitive vaccine.
Sure. Right.
So instead of you already having PTSD and experiencing flashbacks and then going through therapy to try to stop them from happening, this is supposed to they're obviously developing techniques for preventing flashbacks from ever beginning in the first place.
It's really, really a cool idea. Well, I guess we can conclude this by talking about some of the diseases that we don't yet have vaccines for, but people are working on them. The first is a universal flu vaccine.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've already kind of covered this a bit. Lauren mentioned that, you know, when we get a flu vaccine, if you get a flu shot, it typically has between 2 and 4 strains of flu represented within that flu shot. And if you come into contact with one of those strains, you're all right. But then the next year you have to get a whole new flu shot. Part of that is because the influenza is one of those viruses that mutates readily. It's constantly mutating.
Mm-hmm.
And if it mutates enough, then it no longer resembles its old self and your body won't recognize it and can't effectively fight it off. So, like I mentioned before, there's some parts of the flu virus that remain consistent from one mutation to the next. And researchers are hoping that that's going to be an inroad to creating a multi-year vaccine, something that will protect you several years of flu season in a row before you have to get another shot. I mean, eventually you probably will anyway, just because, again, the mutations will be enough where it'll necessitate that. There's also the hope that perhaps they will be able to develop a universal flu vaccine, something where you find that root that is common to all strains of the flu. And because you have targeted that root, it works against any kind of flu you would come in contact with, not just the ones that they are reasonably sure will be the most relevant for that year. And that would be fantastic. Another one, obviously, this would be a big deal, is Ebola. It's a viral infection. So just a few days before we recorded this episode, we're recording this on January 26, 2016. Just a few days ago, there was an announcement from Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which released a statement to support a vaccine developed by Merck and Sharp and Dohme Corporation for the Ebola virus. Now, that vaccine has yet to be approved for use as a preventative for Ebola. It's still in clinical trials. However, so far they've been very promising, having an overwhelmingly positive response, 100% efficacy, according to the papers, which is fantastic, obviously. So next will be a wider range of clinical tests. They're part of the money that's being poured into this development is to allow for a broader array of tests, which could potentially save hundreds of thousands of lives just as a result of the tests. And obviously the hope is that further down the line, the vaccine will be approved for official use. But there are a lot of other companies that are also looking into Ebola vaccines. That's not the only one. That was just one that was recently in the news as we record this. Also HIV. We talked about that earlier. It's another viral infection. Computer models have shown that even a modestly successful HIV vaccine would make a massive impact on a sustainable response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic across the world. So there are a lot of companies that are currently researching potential approaches to developing an HIV vaccine.
Yeah, and I meant to say earlier an interesting thing about HIV, and one of the reasons why it in particular is so difficult for your body to fight is that HIV carries antigens that are really similar to those of common bacteria like E. coli. And so when your immune system sends attackers, they're trying to attack the wrong thing.
Right. They have identified it as something it is not.
Yeah. And so they show up and nothing happens to the virus.
Right. Because again, that antibody doesn't fit with that particular antigen.
And furthermore, the virus can then attack your immune system cells, which is bad times for everybody.
Right. There's also a lot of work in developing a vaccine for malaria, which is a parasitic infection. That's been a target for a working vaccine for more than a decade, but it's really challenging. And that's largely because the parasites responsible for malaria have a very complex life cycle. So protecting against each phase of that life cycle is really challenging. Also, malaria is really good at avoiding the immune system. So it's hard to create a working vaccine to target malaria. But there is some hope that DNA vaccines in particular could lead to a working preventative for malaria. Then there's also pulmonary tuberculosis. So if you're an infant, you get the BCG vaccine. That's effective in protecting newborns against tuberculosis. But that vaccine does not appear to be effective in adults. So as an adult, you can't get this to be a preventative for catching tuberculosis. It does not appear to be effective at all. So there's no booster shot that you can get that can extend that protection later in life. And in addition, tuberculosis is one of those diseases that in the Western world is not such a big deal.
In largely developed countries, it's not a big deal anymore. You tend to only encounter it like watching movies about Victorian age.
Yeah, occasionally, if you're watching a Tombstone and you're watching a Doc Holliday slowly succumb to consumption.
And by succumb to consumption, I mean wear more red eyeliner. Yes. But no.
He'll be your huckleberry, though. So.
But it's still a very serious problem in many parts of the world.
It is. And there have been some outbreaks in Europe, but the issue is that, one of the issues is that, this is going back to what we were saying before, there's not as big a return on investment on investing in a vaccine for tuberculosis. So the World Health Organization has been hard at work trying to come up with financial incentives to actually encourage tuberculosis vaccine development. There's some other ones that are pretty interesting. There's a lot of work looking into potentially creating a vaccine that could prevent Alzheimer's disease. So these are really more about therapeutic vaccines rather than a direct preventative of Alzheimer's itself. So the main target would be this sticky protein that can develop. It's amyloid beta peptides. They form this plaque-like substance in the brain that can lead to neuronal cell death. And there's also the tau protein, which is correlated with dementia. So the idea here is creating therapeutic vaccines that target diseases that produce these proteins.
Oh, okay.
So it's like let's find the early steps that we believe lead to Alzheimer's,
right?
And if we can stop those from happening, then maybe we can head off any development of Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah. That's sort of in the way that vaccines against cancer currently are working.
That's a great lead into the final one. Yeah, there's a lot of talk about developing vaccines to prevent cancer. HPV vaccines are being used right now for mm-hmm. that.
Cervical cancer is caused by cellular changes that are created by infection by the human papillomavirus, or HPV.
Yeah, there are two types of the virus that cause 70% of all cervical cancer. So clearly that sort of vaccination could be a really powerful tool in preventing that type of cancer for mm-hmm. lots of people.
Oh, yeah. Even just the development of tests to look for that virus and to look for those kind of cellular changes have saved it. I think that cervical cancer used to be certainly in the top three of causes of death of American women up until like the 1940s, like crazy amounts of death. So it's coming up with a vaccine for that is really big.
So similar to what we were talking about with Alzheimer's, this is looking at viral infections or bacterial infections that could lead to conditions that further develop into cancer. And if we can vaccinate against those initial conditions, then it's possible that someone who would have developed cancer won't. It's heading that cancer off at that tipping point, that moment that causes it to all start off in the first place. So there's a lot of research in that area as well. Now, clearly, not all cancers are alike. There are a lot of different types of cancer out there, a lot of different things to take into consideration. Some of them are caused by environmental factors.
And there are many carcinogens out there. If you've ever gotten kind of sick of news reports being like, does this cause cancer? And you're like, well, doesn't just everything cause cancer? And the answer is sort of does.
Living causes cancer.
So vaccinations are, even at their peak, once we like get to a point where we're reasonably sure we have covered as many bases as there are covered, likely there are going to be some things that we just can't address because it's beyond the ability to vaccinate against it. However, it's really encouraging to see the work that's going in. And I really hope that we continue to see people advocating for good science, the people advocating to make sure you know what you're talking about mm-hmm. when you're looking at the risks versus reward of vaccines. It's pretty clear from the science that the reward is enormous compared to the risk. That we can't ever say there is no risk.
Oh, yeah. And there's misinformation coming from both camps, honestly.
Sure.
You know, it's important to take into consideration that, like, the flu vaccine is not 100% effective.
Yeah.
Honestly, it prevents the flu in about 50%. In about half of people who receive it, and so it's understandable with that and with other side effects and with general misunderstandings about how vaccines work that people have doubts. But you know, science, guys.
And I never think it's a bad thing to ask questions.
Oh,
right?
Sure,
but
of course.
It's certainly not good to just assume you know the answer,
right.
or to cling to something that has been disproven or debunked. I mean, Loch Ness Monster aside, because she's real. At any rate, guys, that wraps up this discussion about the future of vaccines. I think we had a really interesting talk here about what they are, what they do, where they're going, and why they're so important. Guys, if you have any suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, maybe there's something else you've always wanted to know. What's that going to be like in the future? Let us know. Send us a message. You can email us. Our address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com or drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. If you search Facebook for FW Thinking, we pop right up. You can leave us a message. Or FW Thinking is our handle on Twitter. You can tweet us. And we're always happy to hear from you guys. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.